From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. The year 2005 is ending with more interest than it began in North Carolina politics. There's the cloud over House Speaker Jim Black, just months after he triumphed in getting a new lottery in North Carolina. Congressman Walter Jones of Eastern North Carolina is facing a challenge within his own party in next year's primary because of his stand against the Iraq War, which was a turnabout in the congressman's case. Today, we're looking at what turns state politics took this year and also looking at the future. What does it hold for House Speaker Jim Black? Will we see Governor Easley eventually running for higher office? We welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. With us are Mike Munger, chair of the Political Science Department at Duke University. Welcome back, Mike.
It's great to be here.
And Laura Leslie's here. She is Capitol reporter for North Carolina Public Radio. Thanks for joining us, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start out with Congressman Walter Jones. 3 years ago, he brought us the concept of freedom fries. He was the one who was very much for the war in Iraq. Earlier this year, however, he drew headlines, perhaps because of his earlier very much out there support for the war. He drew headlines earlier this year because he was calling for a timetable to get troops out. More politicians appear to be on that wagon now of getting some kind of timetable out. And yet in Jones' third congressional district, he's going to be facing an opponent in the GOP primary next year. Mike Munger?
Well, this seems to be a question of conscience. Now, to be fair, some Democrats, Biden and Lieberman, have said that they're for the war, so it's not entirely split along partisan lines. But for Walter Jones to do this, I think, was a bit surprising to some of his constituents. It would have been easier for him to remain silent.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we should say his third congressional district has a couple of very large military bases.
Camp Lejeune, Cherry Point, and Seymour Johnson are all in his third district. Yeah, so he's never really faced a strong Democratic opponent in mm-hmm. that district. It seems like a pretty safe seat, but obviously it's not safe from the Republican folks who are now calling Walter Jones one of the inexcusable eight is the word, I think, the term that they're using for this group of Republicans that has decided to split from the Bush leadership and start calling for a timetable.
Mm-hmm. And so he's going to face a primary challenger next year in the run-up to the elections.
He's facing Greg Daugherty, who actually lost to both Balance and Butterfield in the first congressional district on a couple of previous elections. But now he's decided to try for the third, although he says it's not a direct effect of the Jones stance on Iraq. But at the same time, he says that is one of his key motivators.
Mm. Is he moving to that district, or is he taking advantage of what had been the law for so long in North Carolina that you didn't have to live in the congressional district in which you were running?
Well, it's actually constitutional, unless there's a state law that overtakes it, that all you have to do is live in the state. And is he intending to move?
I did not see anything about that.
Okay. Well, the Christmas season is upon us, the holiday season, whatever you care to call it, and that's part of my next question. Walter Jones is one of those politicians who has gone on record in terms of a resolution advocating keeping Christmas in the official language as opposed to Happy Holiday. And not using the holiday season. Is that going to help? Is this considered an effort to rally votes, Mike Munger?
I think it's remarkable that that's as important an issue it is, but it really is something that people gravitate towards. There was a McDonald's in North Raleigh that had a sign, Merry Christmas, Jesus is the reason for the season, and it was a huge controversy, and a lot of churches in North Raleigh were actually taking trips on buses to say we're going to try to validate this. So It's astonishing to me that it's as important as an issue as it is. Since it is, it's almost a no-brainer for Walter Jones to be able to take advantage of. But to be fair, it's also something he himself believes.
Mm-hmm. I think also, to be fair, he has one of his latest attempts is to what he calls protect the First Amendment rights of military chaplains, which is to say that he feels like religious speech is being suppressed in the military. And so, I mean, obviously freedom of speech in terms of religion is something that is pretty high on his radar. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I think if he cared that much about what his constituents thought, I don't know that he would have come out in the first place against Iraq. As Mike said, he could easily have simply kept quiet.
Mm-hmm. But to come back to the religion issue, it had been stated at the time that this idea of him changing his views on Iraq came from his strongly held Catholic faith. He was saying that was instrumental in him coming out in that way, Mike Munger.
Well, it's a strategic problem. It really is a strategic problem to say that we're going to have a timetable for withdrawal. Announcing in advance, that means that all the insurgents have to do is hold out for a certain amount of time. So having a timetable is different from having it and announcing it. It'll be interesting to see what happens after the election. The John Kennedy solution to being able to get out was find a new regime that says get out, and then you can do it with honor. So if we manage to do that, perhaps we could set up some sort of timetable. But I think it was almost irrational for Jones, both for strategic and political reasons, to take the position that he did. He thought that the war was wrong.
Well, that's a story that we'll have to keep watching in the new year, and it'll be there for us. Now, I want to turn now to the State House. Laura, you and other reporters yesterday got an audience with State House Speaker.
Audience.
Jim Black, something he had not been doing, bestowing on reporters for months and months. He had been very close-mouthed.
He has been circling the wagon since all the scandal about Meredith Norris and Kevin Getting started to break in October. So, yeah, this was the first sit-down, call-up, come-and-talk-to-me meeting. And he did extend an olive branch to the press at the meeting, said, we need to do this more often. We're going to get back to doing more of this. But it's as for his motivations for suddenly doing it, he says that nobody asked him to, but the meeting did take place yesterday after a day and a half planning caucus for the House Democrats. And he says nobody asked him to come out and admit to misjudgments and apologize. But there were some Democratic leadership standing around the room. Like, for example, House Majority Leader Joe Hackney was there. A couple other of highly placed House Democrats were simply there on hand to listen to what the Speaker had to say. So you can read that any way you like.
Okay. All right. He said that there had been, on his part, mistakes in judgment.
Yeah, he listed three big ones. He said the first one was in appointing Kevin Gettings, which was one of his lottery commission appointments. But that was, if you remember, a guy who had actually had business dealings and friendships with folks at one of the big lottery vendors, Scientific Games, that he did not disclose on his disclosure form. And that was one of the first fiascos, and that sort of avalanched itself into a whole bunch of other problems, including Meredith Norris, who was a former Black staffer who left his office but continued to work as his unpaid political director sort of in and around his office. At the same time, she is being paid as a lobbyist on some of the issues that she was advising Black on. He admitted, he says, that was an error in judgment. He says there wasn't anything illegal, but it was bad judgment, and I'm sorry.
Mm. Now, one of the things Jim Black said yesterday that struck me in this holiday season, he said he would stop taking lobbyist gifts. And he said, not even a fruitcake. And I'm wondering what kind of sacrifice that is of not accepting a fruitcake.
Well, if you've ever seen the legislative building at Christmas time, you see, I mean, there are goodies heaped upon goodies whenever you walk into people's offices. So,
yeah, lobbyists go down the hall with shopping carts.
Yeah, they have little push carts for that, you know. But no, he actually, the big deal is he said he's not going to accept golf, and he is a man who loves his golf. Mm. But this came out of a part of the scandal that surrounded him has to do with the amount of money that was spent on him by lobbyists, especially lottery lobbyists, for food and entertainment. And he says now he is not taking anything, not even a dollar, even if it's reported. No gifts, no nothing. He's just going to take himself out of it early because I think he's thinking that this will – he went on a lot yesterday about his concerns about perception and the public image of the General Assembly. And he branched out to everybody, lobbyists, other legislators. And I think he thinks this is a good way to restore the public's faith in the idea that this is, in fact, a body that represents the people and not the money interest.
With the new lobbying laws that are supposed to kick in a year or so, would they have precluded him from accepting fruitcakes or golf trips?
Not at all.
No.
They simply have to report anything over $10. But he's saying, I don't, whether or not it's reported, I'm just not going to take it. And the new laws will allow people to sign up on a no-gift registry, basically, to say, just don't give me anything. I don't want your swag. I don't want your coffee cups or your wine glasses or your candy boxes. Just leave me alone.
No gift registry.
Right.
That's a new twist. Now, politically, within his party, he has said he has the full support of House Democrats. Mike Munger?
Well, it reminds me of an athletic director standing in front of a coach with a losing record and the athletic director saying, no, he has my full support. If you have to start saying stuff like that, then it's a bad sign. It may be true that he can get the support back. The public perception, there's two problems. One is the gifts and money that he's accepted. I mean, you can say he's not going to accept golf. He's still going to play golf. He just has to pay for it himself for a little while. The problem for the Speaker is that Caesar's wife has to be above reproach. It can't even have the appearance of impropriety. Second problem is that as far as the lottery is concerned, it looks like Jim Black said, think of me as Santa Claus. And the lottery was in a position where they were the ones receiving the gifts, where the lottery company was in a position of having the inside track And again, just that appearance of impropriety is too much. So that I think is why we're having to have these statements about, no, they had the full support. He may get it back, but he doesn't have it.
And I wonder how that plays with the electorate then, Laura. Because it's one thing perhaps to have the support of those other House Democrats, but if they're going to get backlash at home from voters over this, are they, is the question. Is this a big enough issue? Is it resonating with the voters?
He's aware, I think, of that. I asked him about that yesterday, and he said, you know, that he realizes that it's hard for him to read these things and for voters to read these things and for other legislators as well. But he emphasized that the Democrats want to move forward, and not surprisingly, not to concentrate on the negative in the next election cycle. I think the real issue is how effectively the Republicans in the state decide to take this issue and run with it. And what exactly they can do with it, I think, also depends on a national scale. It's hard for the Republicans to mount a challenge against the Democrats as being ethically challenged when at the national level you've got the Democrats accusing the Republicans of the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And there are still those Democrats. There's that website that's still up, jimblackmustgo.com, of somebody within the party who's trying to get Jim Black to leave.
And he's not going away, but I'm always interested in the fact that I can't seem to find anybody as a Democrat that wants to go on record and say they agree with Jim Sensheimer. So until we see some names and some important names, I don't know how seriously to take that.
Okay. We'll continue our conversation with Laura Leslie, Capitol reporter for North Carolina Public Radio, and Mike Munger, chair of the Political Science Department at Duke University. Jack Betts from the Charlotte Observer will be with us in just a moment, and we will take a look at what's coming up, a legal challenge to North Carolina's lottery. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Melinda Pencava, and today we are talking about North Carolina politics this past year. With just about 2 weeks to go in the year, we're taking a look back at some of the stories. A lot of them are currently in play. That is a cloud over House Speaker Jim Black, the lottery, Walter Jones, the congressman from Eastern North Carolina. We are talking with Laura Leslie, Capitol reporter for North Carolina Public Radio, Mike Munger, who is head of the Political Science Department at Duke University, and joining us by phone now is Jack Betts, associate editor of the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back, Jack.
Hi, Mel.
Hi. Well, what's your take on Jim Black? And we were debriefing Laura, who was among the reporters there yesterday when Jim Black spoke to the media for the first time in a long time. What's your take on his future?
Well, I don't know of anybody who has been in a scrap with Jim Black before who would bet against him right now. He is obviously wounded in public perception, and he has some members of his own caucus who are awfully uneasy about the stories that have come out about some of his choices and where the money has come from and his control some slush fund spending, where they directed how agencies could spend millions of dollars and special money, and so he ought to be in political hot water. I'm not sure that he is with his own caucus yet. There is a little mild grumbling, but no one has come out to be on the front lines within the Democratic caucus, and it's not clear that they have anyone in the House who could overthrow him or even possibly put together a coalition of voters to succeed him if for some reason he chose not to run again. So he is a very formidable politician, right now, there's no clear sign that a change is in the works.
Laura, you're shaking your head in agreement?
I was just going to add, he's also a formidable fundraiser, and
yeah,
that's a big part of that picture, too. And he continues to be, despite all of this, a formidable fundraiser. And so what I've sort of heard in the halls of the legislature is until he can no longer raise money or until he's indicted, he's probably going to be Speaker.
Okay.
He's sitting on about $1 million, I think, and that's part of what makes him pretty tough.
When you say sitting on $1 million, you mean?
He says he's got quite a bit in his political campaign fund. He's raising more money this month, and he has helped, you know, with his political funds, which have been sizable. He has helped a good many members in the House win their election campaigns, and thus he has the allegiance of people of Democrats from an ideological standpoint, and he has their financial allegiance.
Mm-hmm.
They owe him.
Yeah, and finally, just for clarification, because we want to be careful about the language we use around this, we've been saying there's a cloud over Jim Black. Investigations have been going on around him. What's the status right now of the House Speaker being under investigation, Laura?
He has not been subpoenaed, he says, and he says he's been told he is not the target of the investigation. But the people who are under investigation are a long list, most of whom have some connection to Black, including people with close connections like his former political director, Meredith Norris. So it may not be an investigation of Jim Black, but it's very difficult for Jim Black not to be being investigated the way this is set up.
Right. Well, lottery passage, the passage of the lottery happened this summer, and it was actually that seems to have triggered a lot of this closer look at the goings-on in Jim Black's office. It was very big news because North Carolina joined all the other states on the Eastern Seaboard with a lottery. Governor Easley signed that bill in late August. This week, though, a challenge appears to be coming from the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law. Robert Orr is executive director and chief counsel for the center, and he joins us on the line right now. Thanks for joining us, Robert Orr.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Hi. Well, tell us about this lawsuit that is going to challenge the lottery that your group is behind.
Well, the important thing to remember is that this is a challenge based upon constitutional process. It really has nothing to do with whether North Carolina should or should not have a lottery. But the lawsuit is being filed in the form of a declaratory judgment action in Wake County Superior Court with about a half dozen plaintiffs that we're representing. And the specific provision is Article 2, Section 23 of the state constitution, captioned revenue bills, and that requires, as I think you know, that the that bills that fall within that purview have to be read on three separate occasions on three separate days, and the votes on second and third reading entered into the journals of the respected houses. That wasn't done, and so it's simply a nice, clean constitutional question whether the Lottery Act falls within that purview mm-hmm. and is either void because it wasn't done properly, or if it was done properly, then...
Right, because I want to bring Laura Leslie back in. Laura, because the way the lottery bill eventually passed, it passed in a day or two, not the 3 days that Bob Orr is saying was necessary.
Right, it was read in on a day before, but what happens often when it's not a revenue bill in both the House and the Senate is that they'll take the second reading, they'll read it out, they'll take the vote. If the leadership sees that the vote has gone the way they want it to go, they'll say, without objection, the bill will be read a third time. And so then they do the third reading. And so there are a lot of times when bills are passed second and third reading on the same day. But what former Supreme Court Justice is saying, I believe, is that you can't do that with revenue bills and that there may be some case to be made that the lottery would constitute revenue.
Mm-hmm.
I think a very strong case can be made that the Lottery Act is nothing but a revenue bill. I don't believe it's there for the purposes of providing entertainment to the citizens and visitors of North Carolina.
But that's the argument that they're going to make, presumably, and also it's not a tax, so if they're going to want to argue that it's not a tax bill and so it's not revenue within the definitions of the Constitution, you know more about this than I do, and they may lose on that, but surely that argument's not on its face implausible.
Well, certainly the thrust of their argument will be that it's not technically a tax and that the other provisions in Article 2, Section 23 don't apply. That's the extension of credit by the state and the state pledging its faith either directly or indirectly for a debt. But if you look at principles of constitutional interpretation, the first question is, what did the framers mean by this? What were they trying to get at? And clearly, the intent of this legislation is to of the constitutional provision is to provide a special mechanism for these very important revenue generating bills and
to have more deliberation on them. In other words,
well,
to have
exactly.
three readings, right?
And this is really a prime example. What happened with the lottery was that third day, that little window of opportunity for the public, other legislators, to talk to, lobby, generate calls.
Maybe to find the two guys that had gone fishing.
There were two guys that normally had that had previously voted against it, and then they were AWOL.
And they didn't take their cell phones.
That's right. They knew what was going on. Mm-hmm.
They just took a walk.
So this is being filed. Do you think there is a chance that this could delay the start of the lottery in North Carolina? We have the lottery chief who hopes to get it going by April, so he has an incentive to get it going by April. He has $50,000 bonus coming his way if the lottery is up and running by April.
That's why he's named as a defendant in his official capacity along with others. But will it delay? Arguably, the solution is if the governor wants to call a special session of the legislature, have them come back to Raleigh, reintroduce the bill, act it in the proper constitutional process, and then they can move on with it.
Okay. That's on your holiday wish list, or would this be after the holidays?
That simply is saying that it's not so much the purpose of the lawsuit to stop the lottery, because certainly the governor has and the legislature has this other option available to
it. But to be sure, Bob Orr, you oppose the idea of the lottery.
Our organization took no position on it. We were not involved at all in the lobbying or fight over whether there should or shouldn't be a lottery. Some of the plaintiffs obviously were, but our position and the reason we're willing to represent these plaintiffs in the lawsuit is because we're concerned about the constitutional process, and I think everyone agrees that's what's at issue here. We can hopefully move forward with a fairly quick resolution.
Okay. Mel, one point I'd like to make: Tony Rand, who helped push this through the Senate, told our man Mark Johnson that he couldn't imagine anyone saying that the lottery is in the nature of a tax. But in fact, Charles Klotfelter, Duke University professor of economics, has said that the lottery is an implicit tax. It performs like a tax, and compared to excise taxes like tobacco and alcohol, the 35% for education is a pretty high tax that North Carolina has imposed. So maybe the courts will see a tax in there.
Well, I guess as the months go forward, we'll be defining what is a tax, what is revenue. Robert Orr, thank you for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, and I understand, Melinda, you're headed to Oriental, and happy sailing.
Okay, well, thank you, or less commuting, that's what the case will be. Robert Orr is Executive Director of the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law. So that will be coming up in the next year. What else would you be looking for in the coming year, Jack Betts? What stories would you think would be lingering from this year?
Well, we have some things hanging fire. There are commissions that are studying whether North Carolina needs to make any changes to its use of the death penalty. That study did not actually pass the legislature, but Speaker Black appointed the commission anyhow to go ahead and examine the issue, and that comes against a backdrop when we see that juries are convicting and sending to death row fewer inmates, part of a trend nationally, probably. And we have the lingering 11-year-old and the clock still ticking Leandro legislation that will have a lot to do with where the money goes and how our schools perform, not just in rural low wealth districts, but also in the large urban districts like Wake and Charlotte-Mecklenburg. And so education never leaves us, and it shouldn't. It's one of the main things that the state does, and that will be always on the agenda.
Okay. Mike Munger?
Well, Robert Leandro, the kid, his mother, Kathleen, was one of the ones who filed the suit, and she was the first named plaintiff, and so that's what we call it. He's now 25. He graduated from Duke University, and in some ways it seems to me this has gone from, it used to be a court case, and now it's more like the TV reality show Cops.
And We have had him, Bob Leandro, on the show, Robert Leandro on the show, and he says he went on from a school system. The argument had been that the school system he was in did not get enough money.
He was in Hoke County.
In Hoke County. But he did graduate. He went to Duke. He's in law school now. And we posed the question to him then, and I'll put it out on the table now. The fact that he has gotten ahead, does that hurt the Leandro case?
Well, his mother decided to participate in filing the case. The bus that Robert was riding in was so decrepit, she felt like she had to follow it in the car every day. And it's certainly true that there are some people that are going to be able to overcome the drawbacks. The question is, are just systematic differences in the level of spending in different counties consistent with the Constitution? It isn't necessarily what we think is right or wrong. And what the judge has tried, Judge Manning has tried over and over again, is just to say, as a matter of Constitution, it's not. And it seems to me that what's happening is, I think I've said this before, it's like a game of chicken. Every time it comes up, Jim Black says, yeah, I've heard of that case. Do you know any details?
And then Judge Howard Manning comes forward and is happy to provide those details. Is there going to be a constitutional issue here about the judge getting involved? I mean, ordering things of the legislature? Lord, we see that on the horizon over Leandro?
Every now and then when Judge Manning makes those kind of noises, the governor digs deep in his pockets and comes up with a few billion dollars, a few million. But I think this year's budget does include more money for low-wealth schools than it has before. And I think that the lottery is going to bear a big burden for this one, because a lot of politicians are saying, well, this is going to help us with this. Yes and no, the way the money's going to be divided, it will go somewhat more to counties that need it, but it is pretty much spread across the state. And I think that's a liability the lottery's going to have to overcome, is this concept that the lottery's going to fix the educational problems and the overcrowding in North Carolina, because it's not. Mm-hmm. When you look at the numbers, it's just not.
Jack Betts?
Melinda, Bob Orr, who just left us, his last court case, his last opinion before he left the Supreme Court was Leandro II, as it is known, and that decision upheld much of what Manning had found in that case. Not only is there a constitutional right to a sound basic education, but his decisions defined what had to happen. You had to have a competent teacher in every classroom, a good principal in every school, and enough resources to get a sound basic education. The one thing he said Manning had done wrong was in ordering the creation of pre-K for at-risk children. And Manning has since said in a conversation with me that what he is doing now is asking the state and the school districts like Charlotte-Mecklenburg to describe what they are doing to comply with Leandro, to give regular reports of how that's coming along, and he will issue findings on how they're doing. And he strongly implied that there may come a time when he has to step in again and address the issue of whether funding has been sufficient. He has not done so in previous opportunities, and I'm sure he would like not to. It's also not well known, but I'm pretty sure that he and the governor have talked a time or two about what ought to be done on low-wealth funding, and the governor has responded.
The governor only has a limited ability to do this. It's ultimately going to be a legislative question.
We may see Bob Orr sue about this, too, because the governor has ordered millions of dollars spent when the legislature was in session but not done yet. So there's some more opportunities here.
We're going to talk about another funding issue, and this of interest to people in the Triangle area. Headlines today in the papers that the Triangle Transit Authority's plans for a commuter rail system may not pass muster with the federal agencies in charge of that. Laura?
I also heard that our two senators have issued a letter saying that they just don't think it's going to work either, which is a big change, because Elizabeth Dole has been a big proponent of the TTA. She's helped as much as she could, let's put it that way. But I think, I know that there's been, Mike, maybe you can tell me, I think there's been a lot of Republican pressure on Dole and Burr to back off of the rail transit.
Of this mass transit idea.
Right, the mass transit. Maybe it worked. I don't know.
They may also have, you can imagine going with two things. First, it's not going to work. And second, we wish you'd shut up. The first makes the second more compelling.
Jack Betts?
Well, as someone observed this morning, it looked as though Senator Burr and Dole had conferred with federal authorities who have a lot to do with whether the Triangle Transit Authority would get the money, and concluded that from what they know so far, it was unlikely that they would meet current criteria. And, you know, the authority has had the difficulty of trying to fit a mass transit plan into some existing railway right-of-way, and also has had that that terrible problem of what to do about it connecting to the Raleigh-Durham airport. And they simply concluded that while it was possible, it would be prohibitively expensive right now to try to run the train set up to the passenger terminal, and that has probably robbed TTA's plan of a lot of support that it might otherwise have had. So it's, you have a sense that there's so many problems associated with it that it's in really deep trouble right now.
Okay, well, fasten your seat belts because it'll likely come up in the coming year. I'd like to thank you all for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. Thanks to all. Jack Betts is associate editor at the Charlotte Observer. Laura Leslie is Capitol reporter for North Carolina Public Radio. And Mike Munger is chair of the Political Science Department at Duke University. Been great talking with you all through the past few years. Just ahead, we'll talk with a UNC student who is about to graduate. He also has made the short film The Christmas Wish List. That's coming up along with a reprise of the Avett Brothers on The State of Things.